Friends, the first speaker has already extended to you good wishes for the new year. Nevertheless, let us repeat that note and do it this time in terms of the words in this chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. There is this faith that Sanjaya, the reporter as it were of the dialogue, expresses at the very end of the 18th chapter. It's striking that after all the metaphysics and the difficulties, the last verses of the Gita ring out like a trumpet in pure joy. And this is what he says, you remember. Wherever Krishna, the supreme master of devotion, and wherever the son of Pritha, the mighty archer may be, there with certainty are fortune, victory, wealth and wise action. This is my belief. We wish you all these things. We shall be discussing the conditions upon which they become available. But let us wish you all of these things, not only for this year, but for years to come. This idea of offering good wishes on certain occasions has, of course, a philosophical meaning, and part of it was indicated in the preliminary remarks. This is concerned with the nature of time. Of course, in one sense, time, what is it? It's an illusion. It's an illusion produced by the succession of our states of consciousness. That is, the whole reality of anything, including ourselves, other people, the earth, is not present to our consciousness at one go, as a whole. One aspect of it presents itself to us at a time, depending upon many conditions. And then we say it is present. Much more of it is still in the future, which we do not know. The secret doctrine remarks that it is in that future from eternity. That which we have once known, but which has gone into what we call the past, has not ceased to exist. The secret doctrine remarks that it is in the past for eternity. And these two eternities, they are not two, they are only two points of view from which we look at them. But these two eternities make up the duration, says the secret doctrine. That is, the actual, total, unchanging nature of anything, of that reality, is made up of so many aspects which we perceive bit by bit, one by one. And so time really is a dimension that arises because our experience is partial and not total. The reality of anything, says Madame Blavatsky in The Secret Doctrine, is the sum total of how it presents itself at all those times. What we regard as the past, what we regard as the future, and that undefinable thing which we call the present. In that sense, time is an illusion, and yet we are reminded that it's an illusion in relation to getting to know the whole reality of things and of ourselves. But in the manifested world, this time is not just an endless stream. It is never ending, but it's not merely an endless stream flowing here at random, as it were. It has a definite cyclic quality. And that is why in the secret doctrine we have these references about those mysterious divisions of time called yugas and kalpas, called kuklos by the Greeks and so on. These perpetual circles of time are ever returning on themselves periodically and intelligently in space and eternity, so that there are cycles of matter and cycles of spiritual evolution. This is the essential nature, as it were, of how parts and aspects of reality appear within our limited universe. They don't appear at random, they don't just appear as a single string, but there is a cyclic effect. And as a reflection of this, in the world of nature, the large-scale world of nature, the secret doctrine also says, the equinoxes and solstices. We recently saw the significance of the winter solstice in our lecture on Christmas. The equinoxes and solstices, the periods and various phases of the solar course, astronomically and numerically expressed, are only the concrete symbols of the eternally living verity. So this is how we find life. Actually beyond time. Actually beyond three-dimensional space. And yet, present in beautifully structured forms. Not at random, but in beautifully structured forms. And reflected in the very structure of the sidereal bodies moving. Vast suns, as it were, because ours is only one little sun, vast suns sweep through space. And yet in doing so, they become concrete symbols of the eternally living verities. That is to say, everything has meaning. It is in terms of this that human beings have spoken, as she reminded us, that as Madame Blavatsky reminds us, of yugas and kalpas in the Hindu tradition, of kuklos in the Greek, and as Judge reminds us in that chapter which we studied not so long ago, the chapter on cycles, the seros and neros of the Egyptians and so on. Why are human beings so interested in all this? Because it allows them, that's important, it allows them to see the pattern in the vastness of the manifested universe. And who sees the pattern? It's the human mind that responds. It's the mind that responds to pattern. Because otherwise, there would be chaos. If there were a million scattered facts, what would the mind do with them? It is when you see the pattern that, as it were, the laws of thought and the laws of things meet. In the act of understanding, in fact, the human being reflects the original act of creation, because the universe was not created at random. As the first fundamental proposition says, ideas from the divine mind were impressed on the primordial noumenon of matter through Pohat. Now, never mind the technical terms at the moment, but it gives us the suggestion that what looks material to us is nevertheless impregnated with ideas that come from the divine mind. What we think of as abstract ideas are nevertheless great powers regulating the mighty energies of the material universe. That thoughts and things are not left floating in separation from one another, but that they are held together. They are held together in the actual manifestation of the universe. In the act of true understanding, the human mind, as it were, reproduces on a small scale the act of creation. That's why in a different context, you remember the voice of the silence says about man and nature, help nature and work on with her. And nature will regard thee as one of her creators and make obeisance. So behind the patterning the definition of names and cycles is this urge for the human mind to receive what is implicit in the cosmic order, because that is also the divine mind. So you see, Sri Krishna's advice in the 18th chapter, that Mahavakya, that sentence of sentences in the Gita, which is, there dwelleth in the heart of every creature, O Arjuna, the Master Ishvara, who causeth all things and beings to revolve mounted upon the universal wheel of time. Take sanctuary with Him alone. And this is supposed to be the rahasya, one of the secrets of the Gita. It's stated plainly, but it's still a secret because it has to be understood. This advice. This is a way of saying how the human mind is to achieve its purpose. How, to put it very simply, we make sense of life. Now, noticing cycles, the beginning of a year, the beginning of a century, the beginning of a season, is not merely noticing the date and the month. It is noticing that life in its progress has now done certain things, it's about to do the next thing, and this will be followed by the other, to recognize the pattern, the law, what Plato would have called the idea, the things which are behind the flow. Because the flow is a tremendous thing. It's a very powerful thing, and there is only one way of coming to terms with it. It's very powerful because as individuals, you and I cannot do anything about it. You know the joke about the man who was rushing about all day because he had lost a minute in the morning and couldn't find it again. It would happen, because nothing that you and I can do will check the flow of time in that sense. And yet time is an illusion, never mind, but it will not check the flow of time in that sense, because all the millions of beings which together form this universe are in action. To put it very simply for us, the sun will not stop in the heavens because I did not sleep at the right moment last night. It will rise. So there is the aspect of what is called the inexorable, that which cannot be changed or controlled by any propitiation or the use of exorcism or mantras. This is important because actually it is a very great reassurance. It means that the divine idea never fails. The great pattern projected into the universe at its very beginning does not fail. It's a reassurance, but the practical question still remains. What are we going to do? So that, for example, we ask ourselves a question like, how shall we begin the year 2000? Well, we should not do so without the footnote that in fact 2 days of it have gone. Oh right, as we are beginning the other 363 days as it were. All right, but whatever we do or don't do, the year will flow. Because the earth will continue to move around the sun, and the sun to move around its still unknown center of its orbit, never mind. But therefore, at the same time, we have an unchanging, tremendous order, and a human mind free to respond to that order, or not to respond, to misunderstand, to be inactive. All kinds of things are possible. And yet the advice is given. This is how it is done. Something very useful was said in the preliminary remarks, that we notice a cycle, whether it's a small one like a day, or a big one like a year, or a very big one like a century. It allows us to give it a certain coloring. All right, the year will flow. But my life during the year, my thoughts during the year, my feelings, these can be given a definite direction. And there is such a thing as commanding the direction in which one's life flows. We are not the playthings of fate. The cosmic order is inexorable. But we individually, as human souls, are not the playthings of fate. Why not? That again, Madame Blavatsky has commented on or explained in articles which are in fact concerned with such topics as Christmas and the New Year. And as it happens, in January 1890, 109 years ago, she wrote this: man's life is in his own hands. His fate is ordered by himself. Why then should not 1890? You want to say 2000? We can say it. Why should not 2000? Be a year of greater spiritual development than any we have lived through. It depends on ourselves to make it so. This is an actual fact, not a religious sentiment. In a garden of sunflowers, every flower turns towards the light. Why not so with us? This can be effected by those who are courageous and resolute. Thoreau pointed out that there are artists in life, persons who can change the color of a day and make it beautiful to those with whom they come in contact. We claim that there are adepts, masters in life, who make it divine, as in all other arts. Is it not the greatest art of all? This which affects the very atmosphere in which we live. That it is the most important is seen at once when we remember that every person who draws the breath of life affects the mental and moral atmosphere of the world and helps to color the day for those who are about him. If all our readers endeavor to learn the art of making life not only beautiful but divine, and vowed no longer to be hampered by disbelief in the possibility of this miracle, but to commence the Herculean task at once, then the coming year will have been fitly ushered in by the gleaming star. And there are echoes beneath these words. For example, Herculean task. All right, in general to us it simply means a big or a difficult task. But the analysis of the myths shows that Hercules performing his 12 labors has a connection with the sun going through the 12 signs of the zodiac. That it's not only one man who had adventures, that he's a hero. Exactly in Greek tradition, by the way, a hero is a child, partly of the gods and partly of human parents. The hero performs a solar function. He's like the sunlight. It goes beneath the horizon and leaves us in the dark, but it goes down, as it were, in order to come up again from the darkness. If HPB says to us, why don't you begin the Herculean task? She's really suggesting that any determined spiritual aspirant can be like the sun, can plunge into the darkness and difficulties of actual life. One of the labors of Hercules was to clean the Augean stables. He can do all that and come up again with light. In one of his labors, Hercules went into Hades and rescued a prisoner who was locked up there. All of this can be done because the human mind is actually a piece of the sun. It's something that is solar in its nature, that's like the sun. Old Sir Thomas Brown said, there's something in me that was before the elements and owes no homage unto the sun. That it's so great, it's a thing of such a spiritual dignity that it does not have to bow down to the sun. And the secret doctrine explains that in fact, we all are children of the sun ultimately, the sun standing for a center of spiritual life and energy. It is this that is referred to when we talk about the Theosophical New Year. In that sense, anybody can institute a year. These eras of so many which are there, they are not sacrosanct in themselves. After all, what is now loosely called the Christian era, and some people are very jealous about it being called the Christian era, so now they insist that it should be called the Common Era, because most of the world is using it. And AD is replaced in certain scholarly books by CE, meaning Common Era. That's supposed to have begun from the birth of Jesus of Nazareth, though there is a great deal of doubt about the chronology. But in fact, when did the calendar begin? The Julian calendar, which was really the work of under Julius Caesar. It was then revised by Pope Gregory. So the form in which we now have it is the Gregorian calendar. And there was a 14-day adjustment in the 19th century so that there is old style and new style dates arise. That's not a great matter. In India, there are at least two Hindu calendars, two Zoroastrian calendars, and one Muslim calendar that this student knows. Perhaps there is more than one. These are all starting to count from somewhere. In that case, what Theosophy is suggesting is, without comparing or criticizing, why not remember in your starting the new year, why not remember that great event, which is that mankind emerged into this level of being self-conscious, thinking, choosing beings. That before that there was man in form, but not man in mind. At a certain stage, there became man in mind, and this is associated in those ancient mystical traditions with the sacrifice of what are called in India the Kumaras, the Manasaputras, and so on, the Agnishvata Pitris, the solar ancestors or Pitris, all of which is to say that there were in the universe beings with a higher and spiritual consciousness such that they were able to awaken in the human beings what was formerly only dormant or latent, the capacity to be aware of themselves, to think and to choose. It is said traditionally that this happened under the sign of Makara, and also that it happened at a certain distance from the winter solstice. The great sacrificial descent of the Kumaras or the Manasaputras. And by adjusting these calculations and indications, HPB tells us in terms of our present calendar that the 4th of January should be the new year of Theosophists in general, and she says the esotericists in particular, those who really propose to go into the heart of Theosophical teaching and to practice spiritual discipline. She is not suggesting that the world should abandon its various calendars, but that the Theosophy should remember this. Why? Because we come back here to how one gives color or form or shape to a period of time. Here we must associate the flow of cycles with the law of karma. Because cycles have a content, it's not just that thousands and millions of years pass. There is a content, and the content is what happens to the beings, the intelligences or perceivers or souls at various levels of development. What happens to them? That is what it's all about. As Patanjali said, the universe exists for the sake of the soul's experience and emancipation. In those terms, a cycle, as it were, is begun, apart from the great natural cycles, a cycle is begun every time a conscious being starts or contributes a vibration that goes into the universal system. This is nothing very mysterious. If someone just says good morning to a friend and means it, he started a cycle, a cycle of goodwill. If someone looks at another man passing in a car and says, oh, he has a car and I don't, he started a rather dangerous cycle of envy, which was listed, by the way, in early Christianity as one of the seven deadly sins, invidia, from which we get the English adjective invidious. Because no thought ends there. You may act upon it, you may not act upon it and forget all about it. But it's a vibration, it's an energy. And it's an energy that has come from your mind. And your mind has come from the mighty spiritual powers that are called the Manasaputras. That mind cannot stop being an inexhaustible source of dynamic power. We sometimes say something and then if somebody challenges us, say, no, I just said it like that, which is bad English and still worse morals. What do you mean by saying just like that? If we said something, if we thought something, do we realize what we're doing? We're permitting a little portion, maybe a little, but still it's a portion of a divine energy to be directed downwards or against another creature. What are we doing? Because as HPB also explains in talking about resolutions, every man or woman is endowed more or less with a magnetic potentiality, which when helped by a sincere and especially by an intense and indomitable will, is the most effective of magic levers placed by nature in human hands. So positively, she says, let us then, theosophists, use that will to send a sincere greeting and wish of good luck for the new year to every living creature under the sun. And that's, we can respond to that, we can accept and appreciate it. But in the actual article from which that passage is taken, she puts in several further bits of occult knowledge. One of them is that you must include it in your good wishes enemies and traducers, that is, people who spread ill things about you. You must include them. And she says, if you don't, if you sort of distinguish between people you like and people you don't, your attempt to send good wishes may become an evil eye greeting. That the condition, the terms upon which you can really use the creative power of the spiritual being within is universal goodwill. If you don't have universal goodwill, very strange things happen. In a different context, it's said in Theosophy that when somebody is doing anything to do with the inner or occult powers, if in his mind there is the least tinge of selfishness or egotism, the spiritual will become the psychic and dire will be the results thereof. This is the trap, by the way, in so-called religious ceremonies and traditional observances. Some of them may in fact have been very powerful things designed by wise sages. But if they are done by people in the wrong state of mind, then what the consequences will be is entirely a different matter. Because there are things which God or the gods do not accept. And then they go to their own appropriate, the powers flow in their own appropriate channels. So Madame Blavatsky says, yes, everyone has a certain power of will, but you must make sure that your will is pure. And pure means that it is acting not on the basis of any personal preferences, but is of the nature of universal goodwill. Krishna kept on saying in that last 18th chapter, forget everything else and come to me, rely upon me, place all thy works upon me. And sometimes people have wondered, people wonder all kinds of things, they have wondered if these or some of these verses were not interpolated into the Gita when Vaishnavism became a particular sect. Nothing of the kind. They are there, they are a part of the text. The great Shankara has included them in his commentary. And the significance is clear. For example, where he says, Sarva Dharman Parityaj, having abandoned all other religions, come to me. Some Hindu friends thought that this was very encouraging to their point of view. Until theosophists pointed out to them that at the relevant time there were no other religions in India. So he is not talking about abandoning any other religion. So he is saying, give up all dharmas, that is, all other levels and frameworks and codes of life and action, and base it all upon what it said. There dwelleth in the heart of every creature, O Arjuna, the Master Ishvara. Base it on that. Base it on the fact that there is a spiritual presence within the heart of every human being. Giving up other religions means, in fact, giving up what we call religion. It really means giving up all these outward formalities, especially where they divide one group of people from other groups of people. And looking at everyone as a kind of shrine, as a kind of carrier of the divinity within. And in these terms, it's the same advice that HPB is giving. How can you draw close to the divine presence within except by totally overcoming the sense of separateness? The great illusion, we're saying that in one sense time is an illusion, but the greatest of all illusions is the sense of separateness. In Buddhist tradition, it's called the great heresy, Attavada. Because it's a manifest untruth to look at myself or one creature as if it was something, you know, totally inside a capsule, completely isolated from other things. It's simply not true. At every moment I exist by virtue of an interchange with millions of other beings. My digestion would not happen without a lot of bacteria. My breathing would not happen without exchanging particles of oxygen and nitrogen and all the rest of it with millions of people. I would not live for not even a few minutes if the temperature on this earth was not within certain limits. A change of temperature which would be infinitesimal by cosmic standards would be quite enough to kill a human body. I live in constant interdependence with other beings, starting from my morning cup of tea to the fact that when I die, as has been pointed out, not you, but four other people will take you on your last journey. But at every point, the idea of isolation is nonsense. And yet we forget it. The bent of egoism. Sri Krishna is speaking of that. And the approach to any great period of time is to see what we can do about drawing nearer to the self within. One of the things that HPB says is, try every morning when you get up to decide to spend the day closer to your higher self. And she knows that we're not going to be very successful right away. So in the same paragraph you get that sentence where she says, one who does the best he can does enough. But do your best along those lines. And in that respect, a day, an year, a century, they're the same. They are prospective beginnings. Time is endless and beginningless. But the human mind has been granted this grace, as it were. We have this possibility because of the law of cycles that we can begin a cycle. In fact, we are doing it all the time without knowing it. And all that these great traditions and customs says, why not do it consciously? Why not do it with a little thought? As was pointed out, long before the birth of Jesus, the Romans had this sense of January as being presided over by the god Janus, who is two-faced, a face, an old face looking to the past, a young face looking to the future. But then that is a bit of mythology to represent what the human mind can and does do, but should do more systematically, more methodically. We look at a day which is closing, we should be able to see what our walk in life has been like during that day. If we look at a year that's ending, we should be able to look back and see what did we do with it? What was the kind of pattern? Did we go upwards? Did we go downwards? Did we, as it were, stray from the path we were deciding to walk at the beginning of the year? Or have we carried on? What have we done? And then there is the Sanskrit and other Indian languages, they use that expression, Simhavalokan. That is an expression used for survey of the past, because it is felt that a lion, when he walks along, he is not afraid, he is free, he walks, but from time to time he glances back over his shoulder. That picture is a wonderful, and that is used, Simhavalokan, the lion's glance. Your survey of the past should be like a lion's glance. Not with regrets, not with nervousness, not with doubts about oneself. But yes, this is what has happened. This, we have covered this ground, now here comes the future. And with that confidence, with that goodwill, we can walk forward, because the mind of man can do all this. It can make a universe out of nothing. After all, that is how the universe came into existence, not from the mind of one man, but certainly from what's called the divine mind. But where else did our mind come from? Theosophy is explicit about that, that any theory which says that the mind sort of developed by some kind of modification of the body or matter or whatever is out. It's out of court. There are philosophical reasons why this can be demonstrated logically, but anyway, we won't go into those arguments and proofs just now. Because the important thing is to be aware that our minds are a divine gift and that they are capable of shaping the future. However, as the third fundamental proposition of the secret doctrine says, checked by karma. Because we have been doing this in the past, cyclically the effects of the causes which we set in motion will come back, and we must accept them and deal with them. There is no sense of helplessness about this. We should accept the consequences of what we've done and deal with them. In the dignity, the spirit of Prospero, you remember in the Shakespeare's Tempest, at one point Prospero looks at that terrible monster Caliban and he says, "This thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine." He accepts the responsibility for educating and purifying him. And like this, any fault, any vice, anything that has belonged to us, very well, we look back with a lion's glance and yes, this thing of darkness, I acknowledge mine. We can safely do it, because fire is not quenched because you put something in it to be burnt. Fire remains fire. Like that, the true mind, the higher side of the human mind, that which was given by the Agnishvata Pitris, the thing of which every beginning, every 4th of January, every year beginning is a kind of anniversary of the time when very great gods sacrificed themselves that human beings may possess this power. That mind can accept anything in life. Catastrophes. We were narrowly saved from one the other day. Supposing this new year had begun with that aeroplane destroyed and 100 and odd innocent people killed. Well, in our century that has happened. How many people were killed in the Second World War? And how many in the concentration camps where the Jews were put literally into the ovens? Who is responsible? It won't do only to point to Herr Hitler. The whole civilization has to. This thing of darkness, acknowledge mine. In our civilization, this sort of thing was possible. All right, Hitler was a psychotic monster, but it was a civilization in which a great and advanced nation could put such a man in a position of power. It was a civilization in which other nations did not offer asylum to the Jews in time. Analysis and historical details are now available of how many more of those Jews. I mean, Schindler's List is now a heroic story, but how many times Schindler's List could have been saved if certain other people had acted very quickly and willingly? They did not. They made bureaucratic and official excuses. Anyhow, that's not a story I want to go into just now. But this acceptance is one side. That's the side of looking at the past. It's not, grinding your old grievances, but one looks at the past to accept responsibility. One looks at the future to say, yes, but because I have a human mind, because that Krishna dwells inside my heart, all this can still be put right. We can still put things right. It might not be done in 1 year, but it can be done. After all, it is, what is a yuga? Yuga will end. This universe will end, the stars will be quenched, and then what will be left? The immortal soul will still be there, carrying on its pilgrimage. This universe can perish, but the Atman does not. So that we approach any parcel of time. The year 2000 is only one example of a particular section of time. We approach it. How? As souls. As human egos, as beings with creative power, because they have creative power, with responsibility, and yet with hope, looking forward, prepared to use our imagination and our will in the ways that the great texts say. And so that we might as well close this by remembering how all the great Buddhist scriptures end, many of them at least, end by saying, may all creatures be happy. All creatures. And then of course there are forms of meditation based on this. But may all creatures be happy. The voice of the silence ends by saying, peace to all beings. If you have any questions, we'll take them. People ask, are we progressing? And so if we take a review, let us say on an occasion like this, shouldn't we be thinking in terms of examining progress? Yes, the catch is that progress doesn't mean anything until you ask progress towards what goal. And different people will give you different answers about whether we have progressed or not, because the goals they have in mind are different. What is the goal we have in mind? If we have it in mind, to use the language of the 18th chapter of the Gita, he says, you do this, you do this, you do this. With calmness ever present, a man is fitted to be the supreme being. He doesn't say, no, the supreme being. A man is fitted to be the supreme being. He speaks of the perfect devotee who enters into me with no intermediate condition. If that is the goal, then our idea of progress would be very different from the people who examine it, let us say, in terms of per capita income or the number of doctors per every 1,000 of population. And it's an interesting question. So what actually happens is that in every discipline of thought, progress is examined in a different way. And one should reasonably and intelligently do it that way. If you're talking about economic reforms, then examine economic progress in those terms. If you're talking about the progress in psychological knowledge, you will find that you have a little more than people had, let us say, at the beginning of the 19th century, but much less than Patanjali, or much less than the Buddha, or much less than Pythagoras. So there again, the law of cycles applies. If you look at a small period, it may be a part of the descending arc or a part of the ascending arc. If you take a very long view, yes, evolution proceeds. But on this point also, HPB has said something. You see, there's no facile cheerfulness about it. There's a very realistic thing, she says. Look, in terms of the large cycle of evolution on this earth, we have passed the midpoint, and therefore the general drive of the great pattern is now away from matter and towards spirituality. Nevertheless, because human beings have free will and have been misusing it sometimes for quite a long time, the present condition of mankind is abnormally backward. That's the summary of somebody who's, it's in the second volume of The Secret Doctrine, where she's examining from the occult or esoteric.